Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Shawhaus, Judge Larkin, Judge Rodenberg, Honorable Heidi S. Shawhaus presiding.
Good morning. Thank you. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Please be seated. The first matter on the calendar this morning is the case of State of Minnesota versus Christian Deleu Flaw. Counsel, when you reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us, and please take whatever time you need to make the podium to set it at the height you prefer.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Christian Flaw, the appellant in this matter. The district court abused its discretion by denying Flaw's counsel's request for a no adverse inference instruction, because that error violated Mr. Flaw's rights under the Minnesota and federal constitutions, and the state cannot carry its burden to prove that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
What case do you think best supports a conclusion that the district court's decision constituted error?
I think reading the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Carter versus Kentucky alongside this court's decision in State v. Sam compels that conclusion. Because we have Carter versus Kentucky, which stands for the proposition that the district court has an affirmative constitutional obligation to instruct the jury not to draw adverse inferences from a defendant's decision not to testify. And then we have this court's decision in State v. Sam that says that even though a district court is ordinarily required to obtain on the record personal consent from the defendant, that requirement that isn't required when the instruction is requested by defendant's counsel and the defendant is voluntarily absent from trial.
I'm a little bit familiar with Sam, and it seems like this is, I don't think Sam said exactly that it would be error to do what happened here, just that it wasn't error to do what happened there.
I agree with you, Judge. I think Sam on its own didn't explicitly hold that it would be error that the district court was required to give the instruction. But reading Sam alongside Carter, where the U.S. Supreme Court said, this is so important, that the Supreme Court said a failure to give this instruction might not ever be harmless. The court said that juries tend to equate silence with guilt, and the district court, and that's why the district court has such a important duty to instruct the jury not to do that. And so I think, given that backdrop of how important this instruction is, and then Sam's holding that says that personal consent isn't required under this set of circumstances, I think this is the only conclusion that makes sense, is that the district court is required to give the instruction when requested by counsel when the defendant is voluntarily absent from trial. And that's really consistent with the other principles that underlie this case law. Minnesota case law is extremely protective of the defendant's right to decide whether the instruction is going to be given. But that's because this is such an important decision. McCollum says it is a trial strategy decision to be made by counsel in consultation with the defendant. But that doesn't mean that the district court is relieved of its obligation just because the defendant isn't there to personally consent. And I think that's what Sam stands for, especially considered in the backdrop of Carter. And because I think that's the only reasonable conclusion here, the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this error didn't affect the verdict. And the state can't do that here. And that's for a few reasons. Reading Carter, it's clear that the risk of harm is so significant that the jury has this natural tendency to equate silence with guilt and to think that, you know, an innocent man would stand up and correct the record. And there's nothing in this case that mitigates that risk at all. In fact, everything about this case compounds that risk. We have Flaw's absence from trial. The jury is left to speculate, not only, you know, why isn't he getting up to correct the record and assert his innocence, but also why isn't he there? Secondly, this case really turns on credibility. The state's primary witness is PG, and we know that the jury did have some concerns about her testimony because it acquitted Flaw on one count of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. And given that if the jury had some concerns about her testimony, but then Mr. Flaw didn't get up and tell his side of the story, they might have thought, well, if he's not going to correct the record, then what she said is probably true, even if we have some concerns. And third, we have the admission of Flaw's prior statements in the form of the police interview. And there again, you know, the defense strategy at trial was to say, look, Mr. Flaw's second, English is his second language. Listen to the audio. Does he seem confused? Does he seem like he's completely tracking everything that's going on? I also think the jury may have looked at the, or listened to the interview and decided that maybe Flaw was telling Officer Bloom what he thought she wanted to hear. She told him in the interview, you know, I know everything that happened. I know that this happened. And it's in your best interest to just express remorse and tell me, you know, what you did. And she also said when he asserted that he didn't remember what happened, she said, oh, well, you know, people who've only done this once remember what happened. People who have done this multiple times are the ones who don't remember. And so the jury might have looked at that and thought maybe he was feeling some pressure to just go along, and he thought that that it was in his best interest to just confirm the story and things would be better. There's a significant risk that the jury may have had some doubts, but then when he didn't stand up and correct the record, didn't explain his side of the story, they thought, okay, then he must stand by his statements. And so in other words, there's the risk here is exactly what the Supreme Court said it was in Carter, is that the jury wasn't instructed not to follow this natural tendency to think that if a defendant doesn't testify, it's because he's guilty, to draw these adverse inferences. And all of the circumstances in this case really exacerbate that sort of inherent risk. And like I said before, the United States Supreme Court did speculate that this error might never be harmless. This court doesn't have to reach that today because there are so many factors specific to this case that I think that prevent the state from carrying its burden. But that doesn't change the fact that this is an extremely heavy burden for the state to bear, given how it goes really to the heart of the presumption of innocence and this defendant's ability to assert his right against compulsory self-incrimination.
There was an instruction given that the state has to convince the jurors beyond reasonable doubt that all of the elements have been proved, and the judge said specifically the defendant does not, Christian Flaw does not, have to prove innocence, suggesting that much of what you're arguing was sort of inherent in that instruction, wasn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor. And that argument was explicitly rejected in Carter versus Kentucky, where the Supreme Court said, yes, the defense addressed this in its closing arguments. Yes, the presumption of innocence, the judge did instruct the jury in the presumption of innocence, but that's no substitute for the explicit instruction not to draw adverse inferences.
But if appellant had been there, as he was supposed to, and his attorney had said, I'd like that instruction. The judge, obviously, from the transcript we can tell, would have given the instruction, and consequently, we wouldn't have this problem.
Yeah, absolutely, but I don't think we're here because Flaw didn't show up at trial. We're here because the district court denied this instruction. Sam had been decided prior to this case that law was available and in effect, and the district court made an error of law and denied, which impacted Flaw's right to a fair trial, which he doesn't waive by not being personally present. I agree with respondent that he does waive some important rights. He waived the right to testify. He waived the right to confront the witnesses against him. He waived the right to be present. But we know under Sam that asserting this right does not require personal consent when the defendant is voluntarily absent from trial. The district court still had an obligation to ensure that he got a fair trial, even though he wasn't present, and that includes the obligation to instruct the jury not to draw adverse inferences from.
Did the district court have an obligation in the absence of the defendant, or did the district court have the discretion to give the instruction when requested by counsel with an absent defendant?
I think under Carter, it's an obligation. Carter does say it's an affirmative obligation. It's unequivocal about that. And obviously, Carter did not address the situation we have now where the defendant was absent from trial. And under federal law, personal consent is not required under Lakeside v. Oregon. So so for this situation, we are looking at Sam, but with the backdrop of this affirmative constitutional obligation. And given that the personal consent is not required, I think the only conclusion is that the district court was required to give the instruction. And it's a clear rule that makes sense, that does give guidance to district courts. Because you can see with the district court, there is some confusion that, you know, will I get reversed if I give it? Will I get reversed if I don't? And this would provide a very clear rule that you're obligated to give it under these circumstances.
So what would the syllabus point be, precisely?
The district court has an affirmative obligation to provide a no adverse inference instruction when requested by defense counsel when the defendant is voluntarily absent at trial.
Then is it ineffective assistance of counsel if defense counsel doesn't request it?
I don't think there's any case law to support that I'm aware of, but I think it would be a colorable argument given how important. Although, I'm sorry, actually, I'm gonna back off of that statement because, you know, under McCollum, it does say that this is a trial strategy question. And the reason that Minnesota law is so protective of the defendant's right to consent is that the defendant gets to decide what is the best thing here. Under different circumstances, it might absolutely be the right decision to ask that the instruction not be given and try not to draw any more attention to the fact that the defendant didn't testify. But that's not the situation here. So I think with the trial strategy component, it would not be ineffective. So unless the court has any more questions for me.
Just to summarize as I think about this, so the court can't give the instruction unless the defendant agrees to it. If the defendant is there and asks for it, the court must give the instruction. But we don't know what happens when the defendant's not there, but the defendant's lawyer says, my client wants the instruction.
I think that even though we don't have an explicit case mm-hmm. holding that explicitly,
That's the lay of the land.
That's the lay of the land. That the district court, we are asking this court to hold that under Carter and under Sam, that's the rule, that you have to give it, that the defendant doesn't waive his right to counsel, and counsel is who requested this instruction. And really, it's either in the discretion of the district court or it's in the hands of the defendant. And
the case law is saying that when the defendant is present and asks for the instruction, do those cases say the district court must give it or may give it?
Must give it.
Must give it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. So in conclusion, these are new facts, but I think that the legal principles are clear and that this court should hold that the district court must give the instruction under these circumstances. And because the state cannot prove that this error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, this court must reverse and remand for a new trial.
I have one more question.
Yes.
In the case law that says when the defendant is present and his lawyer asks for the instruction, does the case law indicate there should be some sort of inquiry of the defendant so the district court judge knows that that is what the defendant wants?
Yes, that is certainly under Thompson and Gomez, the defendant's personal on the consent record or consent should be obtained.
Well, it must be, correct?
It must be obtained, yes. Except for in the situation where a defendant is voluntarily absent.
Well, then how would we have a rule saying a district court must give the instruction when the defendant is not available to put his personal consent on the record?
We already have Sam as binding law saying that the personal consent requirement is not uh, is is relaxed under those circumstances, or it's just not required under those circumstances.
And then that puts us, though, in the discretionary mode for the judge, and you're asking us to extend SAM to say it's not discretionary, it's mandatory, even though the defendant's not there to do his personal consent.
I don't think that's extending SAM. It's extending SAM in the sense that it's not its explicit holding. But I think looking at the reasoning in SAM, the court said, you know, this instruction is obviously beneficial. Any other holding would mean that the defendant could do exactly what Flaw is doing right now and appeal the refusal to give the instruction. So I think that it's the logical conclusion of SAM and Carter, even if it's not the explicit holding.
Thank you.
The record was a little less clear in SAM.
That's what it
looked like. There wasn't, as I recall it at least, I had to go back and look again, but as I recall it, there was sort of a general consensus between all the attorneys that it should be given, but there was never this kind of specific, I want that instruction.
And I think that difference goes in Flaw's favor, because here we have an explicit request for the instruction. Thank you. We ask that this court reverse.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Everson. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The issue, of course, in this case is whether the district court abused its discretion in declining to give the no adverse inference instruction in the absence of the defendant's personal consent. Now, for three independent reasons, this court should affirm the decision of the district court. First, appellant has waived this issue because it was his voluntary absence without justification from trial that caused this issue to arise. Second,
would that be waiver or forfeiture?
The case law uses the term waiver. The rule, this is Rule 2603 that talks about the defendant's absence without justification, also uses the term waiver. However, there is some commentary out there that suggest that the term forfeiture is more appropriate. I'll use the term waiver for purposes of this argument.
What does the rule say the defendant waives by not being present?
The rule says the defendant waives his right to be present at trial.
And so, what other rights does he waive not being present?
Along with those, he would waive, and again, the rule does not expressly say this, but it goes without saying that he waives any rights that are dependent upon his presence at trial. For example, he would waive the right to personally confront any witnesses. Okay. Along those lines, in an instance like this where a district court is required to put the defendant's personal decision on the record, he would waive any rights attached to that procedure.
Okay.
Yes. So here, because the district court is required at the conclusion of the state's case, when the defendant would be deciding whether or not he or she wants to testify.
So you would read the case law to say that a defendant who absents himself from trial waives the right to request an no adverse inference instruction. In other words, if you want that instruction, you have to be present and request it.
What the state is arguing here is that this defendant waived the issue in this case on appeal. It is the state's position, if a defendant voluntarily absences himself, that it is a discretionary call of the district court. And this is what State versus Sam held, that the district court then exercises its discretion to decide whether or not to give the instruction in that case. But for a defendant who voluntarily absences himself from trial, that defendant...
I don't understand the waiver on appeal argument, because if what you're not saying, if he's not there, he waives the right to request the instruction. What you're saying is if he's not there, it's discretionary. Well, then why doesn't he get to have review of that discretionary decision?
Because it's his...
titled to that discretionary decision.
Sir, no, I understand that, but it's the state's... I keep saying it's the state's position. The state believes that in a case like this where it's a defendant's own misconduct that necessitates this issue or that causes this issue, his absence without justification, that the defendant should not be able to then benefit from his own wrongdoing on appeal and raise this type of issue and receive a new trial.
So it's sort of like invited error is what you're suggesting.
In a sense, yes, yes. And I would say, you know, again, in an invited error context, you would need to show plain error. And there's no case law that requires an instruction in this context where a defendant, in fact, the case law indicates that absent a defendant's personal request or personal consent to the instruction on the record, that the no adverse instruction is not supposed to be given.
And but that, we have a case that says if a lawyer asks on the client's behalf, it could be given.
The court has discretion, correct. And that gets to the state's second point here, and that is that the district court did not abuse its discretion. The Minnesota Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that by its terms, the no adverse inference instruction calls the defendant's silence to the jury's attention. And for that reason, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the instruction should not be given without the defendant's personal consent. And we cite a number of cases in our brief, McCollum, Thompson, Gomez. They all stand for that basic proposition that the district court has a duty to get the defendant's personal consent before the no adverse inference instruction is given, and it must be on the record. Now, given that clear directive from the Supreme Court, it's that this court should not hold that it was an abuse of discretion in this case for the district court to apply the Supreme Court precedent that says no instruction unless the defendant personally requests. And in this instance, I would note the defense attorney made a record and said, implied that he had no idea whether his client would want this instruction or not. So this is not an instance where an attorney said, you know, I talked to my client said he wanted the instruction, unfortunately he's not here. This is a case where we have absolutely no idea whether this defendant would want this instruction or not. And given the clear commands of the case law, this court should find no abuse of discretion in this case.
The safe thing for the district court to do under these circumstances is not give the instruction, because that is most consistent with the case law.
Correct. And it certainly is not an abuse of discretion.
It doesn't look like anyone even mentioned Sam in the transcript, which had been decided almost exactly 5 months before this trial.
Correct. It does not appear as if the parties specifically discussed Sam. What happened was there was an off-the-record discussion of the jury instructions, and then a summary was placed on the record. And the summary that the district court made was, in a sense, that there is case law out there that directs that this really should be a defendant's personal choice, that the defendant isn't here. I have no information about whether the defendant wants this instruction or not. Therefore, I'm going to exercise my discretion not to give the instruction. So no, Sam was not specifically mentioned, but again, what Sam, the proposition that Sam stands for is that it is a discretionary call of the district court when a defendant voluntarily absences himself as to whether or not to give this instruction. And in this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion. I would like to briefly touch on the harmless error, although the state believes strongly there was no abuse of discretion here. I think it's equally clear that any alleged error in giving this instruction is harmless. Okay, this was a really strong case that the prosecution had. We had the victim's testimony. The testimony was corroborated by her prior consistent statements and appellant's act of apologizing to her for what he had done. But most significant here, we have appellant's confession. An appellant specifically confessed to touching the victim's vagina with his finger, which is the count that the jury found appellant guilty of. And I would note there was no clear victim testimony as to the penile vaginal contact, which is what the jury found appellant not guilty of. So I think it was It was clear here that the jury found the victim's testimony to be credible and frankly found the appellant's confession to also be credible. Now, there's been a suggestion raised here that the jury may have inferred that the defendant lacked an understanding of what he was saying or that he was being led by the officer. But if you listen to the interview, which is Exhibit 6 and the transcript at Exhibit 7, it's clear that appellant has a clear understanding of what is being said to him and what he is saying. He
says as much at some point in the interview, doesn't he?
Yes. On page 3 of the transcript, this can be found. He is asked by the investigator, do you understand what I'm saying? And he says, yes, I have a, yes, I get everything you're saying very clearly. The interview then goes on and she asks questions about, repeatedly asks him, did your penis touch the victim's vagina? And he repeatedly says no. So it's not as if he is simply agreeing with everything that this officer says. He pushes back when he disagrees with what the officer says, but he repeatedly, and this is pages 14, 15, and 21 through 24 of Exhibit 7, the transcript, he repeatedly acknowledges, I touched her with my finger. Immediately as I was doing it, I realized I shouldn't have been doing it. I stopped. So it's clear that he is unambiguously acknowledging what he did. And under these circumstances, any alleged error in giving this jury instruction is plainly harmless, particularly when the jury instruction does incorporate some of the elements of this is the state's burden, the defendant does not have a burden. So the jury is aware of the state's burden of proof in this case. So for all three of those reasons, waiver, the harmlessness of any alleged error, and in particular, because it is clear under these facts that the district court did not abuse its discretion, the state would respectfully ask this court to affirm the conviction. And unless there are any additional questions from the panel, I would waive the remainder of my time.
No questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address, I think, three separate points here. First is that State v. Sam does not stand for the proposition that it's within the district court's discretion to give the instruction. The holding of Sam is that it was not error, and that is a very different holding. And I think that's extremely important here because I don't think it was within the district court's discretion to deny the instruction.
But in Sam, the defendant, correct me if I'm wrong, the defendant was not present, but a representation was made by his lawyer that the defendant wanted this instruction.
I will have to look back at Sam. I don't believe it was that clear. I think that the record was a little unclear, but they all agreed that the instruction should be given.
The opinion says, despite a lack of clarity in the transcript, the conversation between the district court and defense counsel is to the general effect that counsel wanted the instruction given. It wasn't clear.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And I think, and here we do have that clear request. And I think that matters.
But in Sam, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm not, the request isn't what I'm focusing on. The request, or what's important in my mind is, does the defendant himself want this? It seems to me that that's the important information. I mean, do we assume that because a lawyer asks for something, he's discussed it with his client wants that? Or, I mean, is that the sort of representation we should have on the record before we give or require this instruction in a defendant's absence? If the cases would normally require the defendant's personal consent.
I don't believe so. And I mean, and the record is not clear here that it was ever discussed with the defendant. I agree with that. But, you know, under Lakeside v. Oregon, another case of the U.S. Supreme Court, the court held that this instruction can be given over the defendant's objection under the federal constitution because this instruction is so important that it overrides any defendant's particular trial strategy, or it can. That's not the case under the Minnesota Constitution. We are much more protective of the defendant's decision. But the fact here is either it's in the district court's discretion or it's counsel's decision. And under McCollum, it does say that this is a trial strategy decision to be made by counsel in consultation with the defendant. And you know, and other case law says the defendant's consent must be on the record. But if at this point we're putting it in either the hands of the district court or in the hands of counsel, and counsel has had many discussions with the defendant, whether about this explicitly, the record's not clear. But counsel is in the best position to make that decision based on their trial strategy.
I think the absence of the abuse of discretion standard in SAM may be explained by the fact that that was being reviewed under the plain error standard, which is error that is plain. So consequently, the discussion was of whether it was error, not whether it was an abuse of discretion because of the standard of review.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And that is why I don't think that, you know, SAM doesn't answer all of our questions. We really do need Carter and Lakeside and other cases that emphasize the importance of this instruction, even though in Minnesota, I think it's because that law is so clear that in Minnesota, all of the case law has focused on giving the instruction without the defendant's consent rather than the refusal to give the instruction, because that hasn't come up because it's so clear that it's required to do.
It seems inconsistent to say, well, the law establishes that this instruction is so important that it must be given, and yet to say, but you can't give it unless the defendant agrees to it.
Well, I
reconcile those two concepts.
I think the principle at play there is that it's the defendant's decision in consultation with counsel. And the
okay,
law
but then if you say that, how do you turn around and say, well, this is so important, it should be given even if he's not there to consent?
Well, I think when you look at the cases, it's very important that it's, you know, it's a trial strategy decision. And here we have this third scenario that's not covered by either by the rest of the case law.
I mean, we could have another scenario, which would be it shall be given unless the defendant objects, and then that would kind of cover that. Not that that's where we're going here.
I'm
saying it seems odd to say this is so important it has to be given, and yet to say, well, at the end of the day, it's up to the defendant. It seems the natural step from that is the defendant's not there to let us know what he wants. We shouldn't give it.
Well, and what the law is clear on is that it's so important that it must be given if requested. And so the defendant doesn't give it. It's not error for the district court to not give the instruction. And the district court, I can't remember the name of the case right now, but they're not required to tell inform the defendant that they have this right. But the law is very clear that if the defense requests the instruction, it must be given.
And the defendant consents. I mean, you've continually said that it's the defendant's decision to be made in consultation with his attorney. In this case, we don't have any consultation. I mean, the lawyer says, I have no idea whether my client would want this instruction, but I'm asking for it. So we don't have a defendant consenting in consultation with his attorney.
But we know under SAM that that's not required if the defendant is voluntarily absent at trial. And that's how we get into this third scenario where, you know, SAM doesn't hold that explicitly, but I think it is implied that in that scenario, the instruction has to be given if requested. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.